This is a Triple J podcast.
Hello, welcome to another episode of Science with Dr. Carl. My name is Lucy Smith, and this week we got some great questions. Thank you so much for sending those through live on Thursday on 0439 757 555. You can do the same next week. We take them every week from 9 a.m. Australian Eastern Daylight Time before we go live at 11 a.m. Or maybe you're just part of the podcast fam. That's all good too. Thank you so much for being with us as we get into questions like, do mosquitoes ever sleep? When you have a song stuck in your head, is there some sort of telepathy going on when it's the same as someone else? And why does sunburn get so itchy? That comes with a PSA. All right, let's get into it. Dr. Carl, how are you doing this week?
Very well. Look, I should point out I'm not that smart. My IQ is only 110, so I'm in there with two-thirds of the population, between 115 and 85. But I am incredibly well-educated because once upon a time the Australian government thought that education was a good thing to have.
T.
And I've got a question for you without notice.
What is it?
How many times in the last 4 months do you think I've put dental floss on my teeth?
In the last 4 months?
4 months.
I don't want to offend you with my answer.
Yep. Pick
okay.
a number.
How many weeks? So let's say it's 12
Three
weeks.
3 months, 4 months.
Okay. I'm going to say you've done it 24 times.
60,000.
What? What do you mean?
Well, last time I went to the dentist, they said, now your dental floss is okay. You know this thing about you can get rid of plaque by using dental floss? And I said, no. And he said, oh, okay. So what you do is you apply dental floss up and down 10 times on the left and right of each of your teeth, all the way from the tip of the tooth down into the gum, at least once a day. Now, theoretically, I've got 32 little white things on my mouth, but actually I've got 28. So 28, that means there's 56 left and rights.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, 56, call it 50. 10 times on each side, 500 every night I've been doing it. And that will get rid of the plaque. You know how you go to the dentist and then they do the plaquey thing and before, you know, behind your teeth, you run your teeth behind you, you run your tongue behind your teeth and go smooth, smooth, smooth. And then once they've removed the plaque, it's all bumpy, bumpy, bumpy.
Mm-hmm.
It's been bumpy all the time for the last 4 months. And so I do it 10 times on each side of the tooth every day. That's 500 times a day. There's 30 days in a month, roughly. So that's 15,000 times a month. And there's 4 months, so that's 60,000.
So what did I say, 24?
20. Well,
I just thought you meant the occasions that you were flossing your teeth, not the actual amount of times.
Oh, it was a vague question. Now, I don't know whether when I go to the dentist in 2 months, I'll say, oh, that's interesting. You have no plaque. Did you take my advice? Well, they'll say, okay, now to get rid of the plaque. I've got no idea.
Yeah. Well, anyway, you've got to let us know what happens next time you go to the dentist.
2 months.
This could be good. They say it every time. They say, you've got to floss more.
Oh, you have
to. Flossing more.
I remember as a medical student, as a junior medical doctor, I did a medical history on this 95-year-old woman who had perfect teeth. And I said, how come you got perfect teeth? And she said, ever since I was a child, I've put a string of silk between my teeth twice a day, all of the teeth on both sides. And I didn't take her advice.
But my question is, do you brush your teeth first or after the flossing?
Mate, I think I do it first. I use the little pokey thing, you mm-hmm. know, a little like a wire brush with little pokey things on it coming out. And then I use a dental floss and then I brush my teeth with an electric toothbrush that does both the upper. It tells me on a screen. I obey my AI overlord from the toothbrush land, which tells me to brush more on the upper jaw and the lower jaw. And then it breaks each jaw into three parts, left, right and middle. And then it's got a front and a back on each one, except for the sides, which has got a molar as well. And we've got these toothbrushes among the family. And there's a very small sample size of three. But on a sample size of three, all the males who have this toothbrush will use it and obey the AI overlord on the screen and try and get it down to about 2 minutes, whereas the women refuse to be cowed by the AI overlord and will not use it.
Well, I just use a standard toothbrush, Dr. Carl.
What, by hand?
What happened to all this technology in there?
Oh, but okay. Here's something for you. Very gently press your finger against the side of your cheek. Okay.
Mm-hmm.
Now press fairly hard.
Mm-hmm.
Okay. Somewhere in between there is the right pressure to apply to the gum, so that you're massaging it, but not massaging it so much that you actually damage the gum. And in the case of my son, what happened was he was told his gums were receding and the dentist said, "You've been using too much pressure," whereupon I bought him the wonderful toothbrush, which has a little pressure transducer and it tells you if you're doing too much or too little. There are many advantages to obeying the new AI overlord buried inside the toothbrush.
Okay. Well, I'll see how I go. Okay. But either way, you've inspired me to keep flossing.
Flossing is good. Okay. To the audience.
Ali in Ballarat, you know, we've been in the bathroom. You've moved into a new rental. What's going on?
So, Dr. Carl, I have moved into a new rental and it really does smell. We've given a good clean. We've had steam cleaners come and clean the bathroom and throw the carpets. But you go into the garage, which is a concrete floor, and it smells like cat wee. You go into our bedroom, it smells like a sort of old used vape. And then the front room, which is soon to be our new baby's bedroom, smells like an old crusty, stinky boy.
How do you get rid of that smell, Dr. Guy? And why is it hanging around despite the steam cleaning? And sounds like you've given it a good nudge, Ali.
Yeah, given it a good nudge. But yeah, I want to know, like, does smell like cling to walls? Can it like seep into more things than carpet? Like, what do I have to do to get rid of this stinky?
Okay, so firstly, do you have to understand what's going on? And follow the old rule that everything is made of atoms. Okay, you can solve a lot of problems knowing that, which, here comes the second part, if they're too close, repel each other, and they're too far apart, attract each other. But here we're talking about smells, and they are collections of atoms, and when you have more than one atom, like two or more, you call that a molecule. And firstly, you're looking at the molecules of the smells from the past, and secondly, the surfaces. So some of the molecules will just sit on the surface, and it might be oil paint, it might be water-based, it might be latex, it might be gold foil, who knows what you've got in your house, but there will be different degrees of attractiveness between the molecule and the surface, and then there's the surface itself. And some of the surfaces are really good at soaking up stuff. I'm trying to think who'd be a specialist in this. All I know is that there are some TV shows where people are coming after a murder and then clean up the house and then solve the murder. That's sort of my knowledge of how you clean a house of smells. Bleach is a bit harsh.
Yeah, it's almost like, you know what, I don't want to be too dark, but I wonder if there are some end-of-life cleaners that have advice for this. No, but genuinely. It seems dramatic, right? But maybe they've got a kind of answer because they're getting to these homes that have been lived in for years and years.
Sean McCann was in that TV show where he'd turn up in overalls and then clean the house and then solve the murder mystery when the cops were too dumb to do it. Unfair on the cops.
Yeah.
So I don't know anybody who does industrial-grade cleaning because you don't want to mark the house by putting bleach. It'll work. Bleach will work. And then suddenly your paint's gone to lunch.
And then you're breathing that all in.
And you're breathing that as well.
Okay. So I need to get onto a funeral home first and go from there, do I?
Isabel from Bendigo saying the smell is probably in the curtains. Ali, are there curtains in the joint?
No curtains. There's blinds, so maybe the blinds. But also the really stinky boy room is wooden blinds. So I don't know if it's – I'm not sure it's that.
Onto the wood. Blinds.
Okay. The trouble there is that wood is very absorbent. And what you can do is sand it back, which is just such a pain, and then paint it with, and I use marine grain varnish, the one that will survive being on the outside of a yacht under ultraviolet and salt for years.
Well,
okay,
Ali, good luck. Let's see if we can get an answer for you.
Yeah, thanks, guys. I really appreciate it.
Ali in Ballarat right there. We got Roscoe in Shell Harbour. Dr. Roscoe, you got a question about mosquitoes.
Yeah, so I've noticed that they basically stick to a ceiling and I want to know, do they sleep? How long do they live for? Whenever I go into this room, they're always stuck to the ceiling like they're hibernating and then as soon as you walk in there, they attack me.
Oh,
and like,
how
long do they live for? And how long, you know what I mean, do they sleep? What are they doing?
Firstly, in general, under benign conditions where nobody's trying to kill them, they'll live for a month. Out in the wild, mate, nature is bloody in tooth and claw and other creatures will eat them, so normally 2 weeks. And yes, they do sleep. And the way that the scientists, entomologists, know about this is that their activity reduces virtually to zero. It's not as though they're snoring and they've got a little blanket and it flutters every time they breathe out, but they say that they go to sleep or reduce brain activity. It's hard to get EEGs on them. So yes, they sleep and they live for 2 weeks to a month, depending. And they can do. They actually have the reputation of being the most dangerous animal on Earth. They kill more people than any other. I forget the number for malaria, but I think it's of the order of millions a year. I can't remember whether it's like 500,000 or 5 million, but it's somewhere in that range. They are the most dangerous animal predator to humans that we have, mosquitoes.
There you go. So they basically hibernate on the roof until they eat.
I think so. We need an entomologist who can tell us about the life cycle. I don't know how much time they spend appreciating art or trying to solve problems.
So they're not really having a snooze.
It's a kind of a reduced activity is what they say. Okay. And it does seem to be weird that most creatures need to have a down... Oh, my God, they just made a weird finding the other day.
What?
So, firstly... With you, when your heart pumps blood, 5 litres, 5,000 mils a minute goes out, and you think 5,000 comes back through the veins, but there's a missing 10 mils, and that goes through what you might have heard of lymphatics, you know, lymphatic vessels, and you have lymph nodes and all that sort of stuff. And in the brain, we've discovered glymphatics, which open up enormously when you sleep and they flush out the brain. And just, it hasn't been published yet, we've discovered that yawning... You know how yawning can make you feel good, but like a decent yawn?
Mm.
That yawning can make the flow of cerebrospinal fluid in your brain reverse. My God, what does this mean? I don't know. I just read it the other day. I don't know what it means.
Wow.
Wow, but there you are. Watch this space. We'll learn more about yawning. So we got to that somehow.
Roscoe, you set us on a tangent, but thank you so much.
Thank you, Roscoe.
Cheers.
Annie in Ngunnawal country, you... Well, we've talked about earworms before on the show,
yes.
Dr. Carl. Annie, you've got a curious case of a song being stuck in your head. What's going on?
Yeah, it's a question about me and my brother. Growing up, either one of us would have, like, a song stuck in our head, and then, like, my brother or me would just start singing that song and be like, oh, that was just stuck in my head. And I... found a reel about it like recently and some Reddit posts and I asked my boyfriend if this happens to him and his brother and he was like, yeah, it does. I had a question like, is this an environmental thing or maybe a bit deeper, and why doesn't it happen with like my roommates or my parents if it's environmental?
It does not happen with them.
No.
Ah, okay, so the word earworm goes back to a novel by Desmond Bagley. I wrote about this in a story recently, called Fly Away in 1978, and you call it an earworm, brainworm, stuck song. And it turns out that if the people who are more likely to catch an earworm, well, those parts of their brains devoted to picking up sound and then analysing it and then emotions as well, they were larger than normal. So it might have been that in many societies around the world, that before they had a written language, they would use music as a way to pass on myths and legends. And just as an aside, in Australia, we have very good proof that the Indigenous Australians have successfully passed down accurate stories of the oceans rising 14,000 years ago through oral tradition. And we know because they describe the path to how you'd get to Rottnest Nile Island before it got flooded. So going back to the earworms, another thing is the use it as a work song. And many cultures have work songs and earworms. And so it has to firstly usually be part of your culture, usually a bit faster than normal, and have a bit of repetition. And the way you can get rid of it is, I know this sounds weird, chew gum. Because the part of your brain that is involved with replaying the earworm also is involved with doing the repetitive movements of moving your tongue and jaw to chew gum. But on the other hand, maybe you really enjoy your earworm.
But is there some sort of telepathic thing going on between her and her brother that means that they seem to get the same song stuck in their head?
We haven't proved telepathy, but we do know that almost certainly they share half their DNA. Roughly. It can be more, it can be less. So if you go out and just look at families walking around in the streets on a weekend, you'll see that in some of them, you go, oh, my God, they all look like the mother or they all look like the father. And so you might have a lot of DNA. So you might have a mutation that you both have, but your parents don't have it.
Oh, okay.
Hang on, that's interesting. I don't know. There you are. We're into the don't know territory.
Strong don't know, but Annie, very interesting.
Thank you, Dr. Annie.
Thank you.
What was the last song you had stuck in your head, Annie?
Honestly, I can't can't remember right now.
Oh, Annie, come on. I'll have to. Well, I'm going to have to ask your brother then.
Yeah, I have to ask him.
Lady Gaga, yeah. Always with Dr. Carl. Hey, we've gotten some texts about Ali's smell problem, yes, in the new apartment that he's moving into. Corey saying, from a professional carpet layer, you will never remove cat urine from carpet.
Okay, Chris? So that's a good thing to know. So cat urine and carpet are a terrible mix.
Yeah.
Okay, right, we got that hard ground truth. Thank you, Corey.
Chris from Lane Cove saying the best way to clear smells from a house is to burn toast in it.
Ah, that's like the old trick of if you fart smellily in a bathroom and somebody's going to use it after you and you don't want them to know that you farted with a very bad smell, you light a match and the match gives off a shower of particles of activated charcoal. So that, yeah, sure, so that will work, yep.
Okay, really good to know. And Robin, you said sprinkling bicarb soda around, then leaving it to absorb smells for a few days before vacuuming it up can be very cost and environmentally effective. He said pervasive smells can also suggest damp, so running a dehumidifier to check that out would be worth doing.
That is such a good thought. Isn't our audience so
clever? They're the best.
You're the best. You rock, audience.
Kynan from Wonji Wonji right here. Kynan, what's your question?
G'day, doctors. My question is, what is the point of having hairy feet? Because my feet are really hairy. I can grow about 3 centimetres a week, and that's after shaving. And is it like an evolutionary reason for having hairy feet, especially in this day and age?
3 centimetres a week?
Yeah.
Hang on. If you shave it with a shaver all the way back to bare flesh, within 7 days, there's an inch or 3 centimetres of hair?
Yeah, that's correct. And no hair on my body grows that quickly either. It's only on my feet.
Wow.
I am totally astonished. I have never come across that. You wouldn't be able to send us photos and maybe win a prize, like with a little newspaper in the background as a time date stamp?
If Kynan sent us photos, we'd have to pay for them, Dr. Carl, okay? He's not giving those out for free.
Okay. So one thing about hairy feet, you got thermoregulation. So the blood goes down to your feet and you lose, it's got reasonable surface area, and you lose the heat into the outside world and the hair acts as a bit of an insulator. Penguins and a few other creatures have got a trick where the heat is exchanged from the warm blood in the artery to the cold returning blood in the vein before it gets the foot. But we humans don't have that, so the thermoregulation is one thing. Potentially stop a bit of damage, like not really, like... But if you're growing a centimetre a week, you could probably strangle insects.
But from...
if it's growing that fast, I'm thinking of some horror movie here.
Is it from... But from an evolutionary perspective, we obviously have hair on our toes. Everywhere. Was it for warmth?
Warmth and also maybe slow down insects, but also sense insects. So if something lands on your flesh and is going to burrow down and sting you to death and then do lay eggs in you or something like that, you would get warning by the hairs being moved on your feet.
Oh, wow.
I think that'd be the main reason. We need an evolutionary biologist to take us further. Are you sure about that 3 centimetres a week?
Yeah, 3 centimetres a week. I've been measuring for a couple of weeks, actually, because I've been trying to get on with you guys for a while. So,
okay, what you need to do is get, there's a thing called a newspaper, you've heard about them, buy one of those, have it in the background of your photo, put your photo, put your feet there, and then shave your feet, right? Shave your feet, and then every day get a new newspaper and photograph your foot on that day's newspaper, and then we want to close up with a ruler, and you'll definitely get something from me, and maybe a Triple J pencil if we've got one
somewhere. Want the proof, Dr. Carl?
I want the proof. It's astonishingly fast.
I think you just want to see my feet, Dr.
Yeah,
Carl.
So do I, yeah.
Okay, all right, we all have our different loves. Okay, we'll just leave it right there.
Kynan, let's see what we can do. But we've got Connor in Darawal country. Now, Connor, you work in a bar. What have you noticed?
Hey, doctors. Yes, I do work in a bar, and I've got a bit of a gastronomy question for you today. So it's a neo-tiki rum bar called Scoundrel's Rest down in Wollongong, and our bread and butter is anything that makes people feel like they're on holidays, which means naturally we need to have frozen pina coladas and frozen strawberry daiquiris, and then the cream of the crop, the Miami Vice, which is a half and half of both of them. Think Hannah Montana, best of both worlds.
All right, Connor, we can't be plugging the bar. Let's get into the question.
We've got the air out of the way, right?
I promise it's relevant. So my question is about the Brix content of an alcoholic slushy. For the Miami Vice to work, it needs to be solid enough so that each layer sits on top of each other.
Ah.
And the bricks content I know needs to be approximately 15% bricks between 13 and 17.
Right. Now, bricks is a measurement of sugariness. Do you actually have a bricks meter? I've read about it, but I've never seen one.
I actually don't. I've seen them too, but I've just been working out bricks through calculations, assuming that caster sugar, as it stands in its natural form, is 100% bricks.
Yep, 100 bricks, yep.
So why is it exactly that an alcoholic slushy needs to have 15% bricks for it to actually get a good consistency?
Okay, the mouthfeel of a slushy, and I do think that cocktails and some alcoholic drinks are the highest form of Western culture that we've managed to develop. A good slushy, you have to have a mix of cold liquid and ice crystals, and the ice crystals have to be of the right size, and it has to be the right ratio between them, because at one extreme, you're just licking on this solid block of ice. And at the other extreme, you've got just cold liquid, which is unpleasant. Not unpleasant, but it's not as pleasant as the mouthfeel, where you've got these tiny crystals that, as they touch the warmth of your tongue, they melt and release a little burst of flavour. Now, it turns out from your, you know, what we call ground truth, that 15% is a magic number. Why 15%? I don't know. Why isn't it 17 or 20? But do you agree that it's the ratio of the frozen tiny crystals that have to be tiny and the amount of water? Is that what gives you the nice mouthfeel, as they call it?
Yeah, having those nice, tiny, tight ice crystals close together, giving you that
don't know.
Liquid but solid consistency.
Okay, we need a food chemist to tell us why that mouthfeel is so good, but I reckon it's purely that the crystals are small enough to melt when they kiss your tongue and release a burst of flavour. If they were bigger, they wouldn't do it, and if they were too small, they'd do it so quickly you wouldn't notice. You want that slight time delay. I don't know.
That's fascinating.
I'm guessing.
Does that help, Connor?
That is very fascinating. Thank you. Yes.
It is. Thanks, okay, Connor. Wow. Another kid from the Gong.
Love that.
Kate in Westbury, Tasmania. You saw Dr. Carl speak during Science Week last year.
Yes. You came to Devonport last year. So thank you very much for coming down to Tassie.
Oh, it was so much fun. Were you at the fun one for the audience or the schools gig?
At the evening one for the audience, but there were still lots of kids there, so I didn't get a chance to ask my question, which is what I texted in today.
Yeah,
one of the things that you were talking about was that coffee and chocolate have opposite effects, and I can't remember whether it was like heart rate or whether it was like one's an upper and one's a downer or something like that, but you were saying that like chocolate balances out coffee, so we should always have chocolate with our coffee.
Okay, so firstly, with regard, sorry, go.
No, you go ahead, because so, I can't remember what the effect was, okay, and I'm hoping that you do.
Okay, so a general philosophical thing is that when I'm doing shows, I'm now going to have a Q&A, such was a great success at the Enmore Theatre with Triple J, where we try to get as many as we can through in 3 to 5 minutes, because I went to a show with Peter Singer, and the trouble was that the questions didn't all get answered, and I felt sorry for the audience, so we've got to have a quick Q&A, so we're going to do it, and we'll be able to answer your questions. It goes like this. The active ingredient in coffee is called caffeine, and it's two circles of carbon, you know, rings of carbon, 5 and 6 carbons in a ring. There's two of those rings stuck together, and hanging off at 3 points are methyl groups. They're CH3. They're little, they're one atom of carbon, 3 hydrogens. So the formula is 137, because that's where they are if you go clockwise. Trimethyl, there's 3 of them, and the xanthine is that double ring in the middle. Now, there's chocolate, which has the name of theobromine, according to Linnaeus, which literally means drink of the gods. That's how how highly he valued it. And it's got an incredibly similar formula. It's got the xanthine, the two carbon rings, the rings of carbons. And instead of 3 methyls, it's got 2. So instead of being 137, it's 37. And instead of being trimethyl, it's dimethyl, but it's still xanthine. they have opposite effects on your blood pressure. One of them closes down your blood vessels, and the other one opens up your blood vessels. And this answers the deep philosophical question that the philosophers have not been able to answer for thousands of years of, is there a God? And the answer is, yes, there is a God. And if you drink coffee, when you drink coffee, if she exists, she wants you to have chocolate with coffee, because one opens up your blood vessels and one closes it down. How much you need, I have not been able to find that in the peer-reviewed literature, but I would reckon follows that old rule of a little is good but too much is bad.
Mm-hmm.
So have enough chocolate that you want to have more and then stop before you have that extra one. Whether that's one bar or one QB or 10 packs, I don't know.
Because, yeah, I was wondering how much chocolate should I put in my mocha to be able to balance out my blood pressure.
Well, just a little bit. A little is good, too much is bad.
Does that help, Kate?
Oh, and there's a special word from Sweden. I've started watching shows on Swedish death cleaning.
Oh, yeah.
You've been into that. And what's the word logrom, which means not too much, not too little, just right in between with regard to how much stuff you get rid of and pass on to somebody else.
Hang on one second. What's Swedish death cleaning?
Swedish death cleaning is the cleaning up of the house that you do before you die during your life, so that what happens when people die is that they go, why did they store 50 million copies of this? And there's stuff that they haven't used. And so the philosophy is that on one hand, you're making it better for the people who come after you to have to clean up your mess when you're dead. But on the other hand, you reduce the clutter so you can live your life more fully while you're alive.
Oh.
And it's on SBS, which is, I'm allowed to mention, because it's another government TV station.
Yeah, go for it.
Yeah, Swedish death cleaning.
That's awesome.
Okay, and the word is, I think it's logrom, L-O-G-R-O-M, which means not too much, not too little. That's the amount of chocolate you should have.
Does that help, Kate?
Absolutely. Thank you, Dr. Carl. Thank you, Dr. Lucy.
Now, Carl, earlier in the show we had a question from Ali, who was moving into a new rental and the smell was just hanging around, different smells in multiple rooms, and he wanted to know why those smells seem to cling to these surface areas. And Charlie from Tassie, we've had a lot of people come through with a device, more than anything, saying often odours get stuck in the fly screens. We've had to replace fly screens in rentals in the past to get rid of odours.
I would not have thought of fly screens. We love you, audience.
Yeah,
Lucy
come
and
through.
I love you to pieces. That's official.
We really do. That's comments, amazing. Questions, bring them through on 0439 757 555. And if you've just joined us, you can hear Ali's question on the podcast. Bree from Wonga Park in Victoria, you've got a question about sunburn.
Yeah, hi. My boyfriend Sam actually wants to know why sunburn gets so itchy. Mm.
Ah, do you get sunburned?
All the time.
Oh, come on, no.
I know, it's really bad. But you go to the beach and then you forget and
You can't forget.
You remember.
Australia is the world capital for skin cancer and melanoma. And You'll now use sunscreen, I'm sure of it.
PSA.
That's your PSA for the day. I'll stop whinging. So firstly, when the ultraviolet lands on the skin, it actually injures the skin cells. It damages the DNA, and most of the time it repairs itself, but not all the time, which is why you get the cancers. But as a result of damaging the skin cells and the DNA, that triggers the immune system, which then goes in to fight the damage and repair it. And there are chemicals like prostaglandins and histamines, the itchy ones, right? They get released and that makes the skin itchy.
Wow.
Secondly, there's another phase called epithelialization. The epithelium is the surface layer and you're repairing that. And we're not sure why, but that also there's an itch associated with that. And finally, you can actually damage the nerve endings, and as part of their repair process, they get itchy as well. I tend to use, when I see red skin on any of our family members, sorbolene and glycerin, because I reckon it'll cure anything from sunstroke to syphilis and varicose veins, and I just wodge it on nice and thickly, and I think it repairs it. Is the sunburn healing okay?
A bit. We've been lathering on aloe vera and moisturising stuff, but we should try the sorbolene like you suggested.
That'll work. But the other thing is that you could, we thought, rely on the sunscreens in that if it said SPF insert number, it was what they said, and some of them were only 4% of what they said. Mm. So go to the ABC articles on the sunscreen and choose the ones that they recommend that are at least close to what they say. And you've got to put on more than you think. Like, imagine the tip of your finger, of your little finger, from the end joint to the very tip. That's how much you should put on one arm. And then the same on another arm. And the same on your chest and the back. You just layer it on like crazy. You use more than you think. And you've got to apply it every 3 hours. Mm-hmm. I'm sorry.
Lather it on.
Right. Lather it on. I'm sorry.
I'll have to lather up.
Okay.
Thanks, Bree.
Thank you, Bree.
Thanks.
And we were talking about UV light. Mm. Jason in Warrenwood, you got a question about blue light.
Dr. Carl, Dr. Lucy, I do. I've been sitting in my sauna, which has like a colour therapy light, and you can change the colours. And every night I've been trying to get in the sauna before bed most nights, just to sort of drop the cortisol levels and relax, you know, sort of calm down a bit. And I was in it last night, and the colour that I found that's most sort of, I suppose, relaxing or peaceful at night time is a blue, a really sort of light coloured blue light. And I just sort of wondered last night that could that do the same, have the same impact, that blue coloured light, have the same impact on my brain and my eyes as what my phone screen blue light would be, or are they two different kinds of light?
Mm. And are you talking about the keeping you awake type effect? Is that what you mean?
Yes, yeah.
Well, okay, so this is how it works. So in your retina, you've got, in each retina of each eyeball, you've got about 2 million cells that fire off really strongly when you see green, about 2 million that fire off really strongly when you see red, and 10,000 when you see blue. Only 10,000. I helped do some research on this in New York a couple of decades ago. And what happens is that very weak signal, because only 10,000, gets amplified somehow in your brain. Now, that's one bit of background. The second bit of background is the pineal gland. So René Descartes, who was a philosopher, he was the guy who said, I think, therefore I am, and also the guy who invented Cartesian paper, like you used to use at school on graph paper, was also an anatomist as well. And he discovered the pineal gland, which is a centerline gland in the brain, which manufactures melatonin. Now, when teenagers, once they hit puberty and then have difficulty in getting to sleep before 9 o'clock at night, the reason for that is that their pineal gland is manufacturing lots of melatonin and later. So they don't get tired till 10 or 11 and they need 10 hours sleep all through that period from about 13-ish to early 20s. But there was some research that showed that blue light interfered with the pineal gland giving off enough melatonin. And from that came out the whole, blue light is bad for you, try to avoid it. We've backed off from that a bit, and in general, you don't want to have too much blue light before you go to sleep. With regard to the sauna, if you can change it to another colour, do it. But here's the question, do you find yourself still able to sleep easily?
Look, it's certainly improved my sleep. I've always been a terrible sleeper, and since doing the sauna for the last couple of months, it's definitely had a bit of an impact, and I tested it a couple of weeks ago where I didn't sauna for a few nights and then my sleep went back to being terrible.
Okay, well, as another example of things I've learned from my children, one of my daughters has a smartwatch and she's saying, hey, I'm getting 99% sleep, but in bad times I get 80%. And I said, how do you know? And she shows me the app on her watch which monitors during sleep. So do you happen to have one of those watches that monitors
I've got one of the rings that monitors the sleep. Yeah.
Oh, yeah. Right. And so time for your chance to get the Triple J fun pack. Okay, 1 week of you do the sauna with a red light and you tell us what number the ring tells you, which is monitoring your sleep, and then 1 week with blue light, send it to Triple J to whatever the email address is, I don't know, and then you're on the way to getting a fun pack maybe.
I like that,
Jason. Fantastic.
Yeah.
Thank you. And thanks for also explaining about the teenagers, because you've now explained why my daughter doesn't want to go to bed at 9:30 at night when she should. So thank you. You've answered two questions for me.
And when we find that around the world, when you go to the trouble of mucking up society and having high school start 2 hours later, which means you've got different bus transport schedules, the parents can't drop them off, it's messy for everybody except the kids. Mm. If you get your average teenager, you know, and put them who's going to school, and then at school you do an experiment, say, oh, just lie down here while I've got these electrodes on your head, they will drop off into deep sleep, not in three-quarters of an hour, but 5 minutes. Overwhelmingly, teenagers are sleep-deprived all the way through high school, and when they shift the start times of the high school to 2 hours later,
wow,
the kids do so much better, but wow, the rest of society has to pay us a price. I reckon it's a worthwhile price. I love teenagers. We got to help them.
Thanks, Jason.
Thanks so much.
Thank you.
Adrian on the Gold Coast, you've got a question about the Willow Project. What's going on?
Hi, I just wanted to know. I know that Google is breaking some grounds in quantum computing, and they've got a Willow chip that's able to do calculations in under 5 minutes, which would take our supercomputers traditionally 10 skiptillion years, which is older than our universe. Whoa. So I just wanted to find out, you know, if Dr. Carl knows about this and could explain it and tell me, you know, what the kind of breakthroughs with this technology would be.
Well, we're talking quantum computers, and they've been thought of for a while, and their strength is that they're able to do many parallel calculations at the same time. And luckily, I had lunchtime on Tuesday with three junior scientists in physics on the top floor who are all working in quantum computers. And I said, oh, come on now, are they real? Do they actually work? And about 5 years ago, quantum computers could pretty reliably tell you that the two numbers that made up 15 were probably 5 and 3, and they were fairly sure of that. That's how good they were 4 or 5 years ago. Now, on certain very small tasks, they can do things better than conventional computers, but they're very useless tasks. They're hyping like crazy. The problem with the quantum computer is that they're pouring in money like crazy and not getting anything back. They will get something back, almost certainly. And the big thing will be that they'll be able to break not just credit card security, which doesn't really matter to the governments, but the encryption on all of the emails and texts. So all of the governments of the world have got snooped upon emails, which has got all sorts of interesting information, and they can't read them. And when they get the quantum computers, they'll be able to read back and say, oh, so Lucy Smith was actually a spy for the New Zealand government bringing nuclear weapons or something like that. And then they'll go out and they'll do something bad to Lucy or whatever. So at the moment, they are hyping up much more than they can do. And what they're saying, when they can do something in 5 minutes that would take a conventional computer a septillion years, what they mean is that they can do something really well. And if it were to run for 5 minutes, then it would be that much faster than a conventional computer.
Well, I'm not quite sure if you're aware, because the Willow chip that Google has produced, it uses multiverse technology where it's doing the calculation on different multiverses and confirming the multiverse theory. So that 5 minutes of calculation that it does would take, 10 skiptillion years with a quantum computer, but it splits the load across multi-dimensions, which I thought was just completely out there.
It has not been proved that these multi-dimensions exist.
But
they're giving you a bit of hype. Sorry. Okay.
All right, well, just wanted to find out if that was going to maybe be a breakthrough for quantum, which would reduce the power cost,
It comes all the time. They keep on talking about quantum supremacy, and they're still not there yet, and they all claim it, and we're still not there yet.
We've got Kayla in Newcastle. Kayla? Just quickly before we knock off, Kayla, what's your question?
What is a cold shiver, and why do they happen? Like, when a dog's wet, it shakes off. Why do we shake off cold?
When you're shaking, having that cold shiver, it's normally happening not under your control, unlike rubbing your hands together, and you're not moving your big muscles. If you're moving your big muscles, suddenly your hand might come and hit your face. You're moving the thin layers of muscles on your skin, and they also trigger off the hair follicles. So that's exposed by a fever. It's set off by a fever or exposure to cold. Your brain is wired up via the hypothalamus to move those small muscles. You can occasionally have a severe illness without a fever and you start shivering even though you haven't got a temperature. It's emotional stress can set off. Certain medications, now you're running into the grass, like having very low sugar levels from hypoglycemia, a thyroid storm, very rare. Dehydration, what can you do about it? It depends on what the cause is, and then you can treat it. So if it's an illness, you'd give them an antibiotic, depending if it's a bacterial infection, not a viral. And so the treatment depends on what you've got. So it's overwhelmingly your hypothalamus sending off signals to let the little muscles move backwards and forwards and create friction.
So it's my brain like triggering it itself.
Yeah. Look up Wikipedia about the hypothalamus and follow where it does the thing called thermoregulation.
Thermoregulation.
Yeah, I know. So hypothalamus, hypo, H-Y-P-O, thalamus, which means below the thalamus, and then thermoregulation. Mm-hmm. That's your homework. You didn't expect to get any, did you? I'm sorry.
I didn't actually, but I'm going to go get my textbooks out.
Thanks,
Wikipedia's
Kayla.
Great.
Thank you.
Thank you, Kayla.
All right. That's another episode done in the can. Dr. Carl, thank you so much for joining us and answering our science questions.
Thank you so much. And it's been so much fun.
Yeah.
And I'm sorry to have thrown you that question about how many times I put dental floss on my teeth without notice.
If you're just joining us and you want to know how many times Dr. Carl has flossed his teeth in the last 4 months, listen back to the podcast wherever you get them and we'll have a fresh episode for you next week.
Roger.
I can't.
Roger. Roger. Peace, love, mung beans. Got it.
Roger that. And that's it. Thank you so much for listening to this week's episode of Science with Dr. Carl. There is plenty more for you in the podcast feed, so feel free to scroll back, listen to your favourite eps, like, subscribe, rate, leave a comment. Whatever you got to do to make this appear in someone else's feed. It's all showing the love. I'm Lucy Smith. This episode was produced by Josh Brennan, and we'll catch you next week. Bye!
Dave Marchese here from the Triple J Hack team. Hey, if you love Dr. Carl's podcast like I do, you might enjoy the Hack podcast as well. Each day, we bring you the news that matters to you, from the latest science on climate change to what's happening in politics and news around the world. The Hack Podcast. It's your daily fix of the news you need to know. Get it wherever you're listening now.